Well, some plants seem to thrive no matter what the conditions, the location, or the amount of care you give them, and others seem to be a disease magnets. Oh, man, we're lucky to have two experts here to help us figure everything out today. What went on in your garden this year, how to avoid problems next time around, maybe a little bit about pruning, too. Brian Huddleston, director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic, one of our guests at UW-Madison. He's in the Department of Plant Pathology. Old Dr. Death, how are you, sir?
I'm doing well. Thanks, Larry, for having me today.
And Laura Joel. Laura has been with us many times, professor in the Department of Horticulture and UW Extension Woody Ornamental Expert.
Yes.
Let's
trees
put it
and
that
shrubs.
Way. Yeah, great to have
Good
you here.
Good morning. Thank you. And the token tree hugger.
Token tree. She hugs her trees, let me tell you.
I do.
Oh, man.
And I watch them die, yes.
No. he watches them die. Oh, my goodness. You can join in if you have questions or comments. Virtually every phone line is already full. But the number is 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can post on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you. And I don't know, we could just jump right in. Well, let me jump in with one of my notes. I do a little 3-mile jog around the neighborhood every morning, and so, or sometimes in the evening. And so I have seen virtually, and this is 3 miles, every maple tree in that 3-mile stretch has tar spot. Black spots on virtually every one.
Brian. Yes, indeed. That's very typical. We have a lot of Norway maples as street trees, and actually the fungus that's causing that disease got imported from Europe into the U.S., so it's a European tree. It's a European fungus, and they found each other in a great environment this past summer, actually. It was a little bit on the wetter side, so we saw a lot of tar spot on a lot of different maples.
It's not going to kill the maples.
It's not a fatal disease. It will cause some defoliation on occasion if you get a lot of infections per leaf. I have not seen it quite that bad in our area, although in other areas of the state it has gotten to that point. Usually when I see leaf loss, it's relatively late in the growing season, so it typically doesn't have a real big impact on the trees.
Yeah, and I haven't noticed any on the campus, on the UW-Madison campus. I haven't seen any.
I haven't looked
looking for it, and I haven't seen it.
You can come to my yard and see it, Larry. I have plenty of it in my yard. So,
why am I not surprised?
Oh.
Well, I made the cardinal mistake with that disease when I first started seeing it on the Norways in my block, and I to always tell folks, good fall cleanup, rake up the leaves and get rid of them, and I didn't do it that fall, and I convinced myself that I would do it in the spring before the trees leafed out, and of course, I didn't do it, so we had just tons of inoculum around, so lots of fungal spores that reinfected the trees.
Well, there you go. And this is a good time to be pruning, or is it a little bit later?
I would wait until late winter, early spring, before growth starts emerging. You can prune now, but there's still some plants still have leaves on them. You want to wait until after the leaves drop, so that the carbohydrates are from the leaves are shunted to the rest of the plant and into the root system.
Just as an aside, it seems like a really good color year for me.
I'm seeing, at
least southern Wisconsin.
I'm seeing fall color on plants that I normally don't see fall color on. I have some Korean spice viburnums in front of my window at home. And yes, they do have some burgundy fall color every year, but this year it's almost,
spectacular.
Spectacular, yeah.
Yeah. Pretty cool. Well, Catherine in Random Lake has a question, so let's go there. Hi, Catherine. Thanks for calling.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I rooted mock orange this spring, and I've done this one other time. It was the year that I put it out over the winter after I had it rooted, and that was the March when we had the 80-degree weather, and then the April where we had the cold weather, and that killed it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very important for me to get this plant because it was one that belonged to my grandfather, and it's really special to me. So for the second time, I failed. I have failed year after year after year to get its roots. So I finally got one rooted. I had it in a terrarium all summer, and a friend of mine said, oh, get it out of the terrarium. So I have it in the house. I'm afraid to plant it outside. And I want to know how I can get it through the winter.
Okay.
I need suggestions.
Sure. Okay. First of all, I don't know where Random Lake is.
It's right next to Lake Michigan. We're about 5 miles as the crow flies from Lake Michigan, on the very southern end of Sheboygan County.
Oh, okay. No problem. It's Random Lake.
Yep.
So when it comes to the mock orange, there's a couple things you can do. I mean, it is a woody ornamental. It needs to go through a dormant period in order to initiate flowering for next year. Granted, I don't know how big your plant is. I assume it's about a foot tall.
No, it's closer to about 6 inches tall.
Oh, okay, really little. Okay.
It's a tiny little one. Yeah,
I won't flower yet. It's too little. But
right. What
I have done with some of my tender plants is I have them in my unheated garage in the winter.
Okay.
Wait till all the leaves fall off. They should fall off. Take the leaves away and just put it in a pot and put it on a shelf in your garage. Make sure it's up off the floor. It's on like a shelf or something. And you probably want to insulate the pot, because if it's too, I don't know what kind of pot it's in. If it's in clay pot or ceramic pot, you're going to want to take
plastic.
It out. Plastic's fine.
Pot.
Yeah, they won't crack. But yeah, I would probably place some burlap around it, kind of insulate that root system. But you can leave it in your garage, and then next spring I'd plant it outside.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The leaves are kind of shriveling instead of turning color and falling off. Do I have to be concerned about that?
Well, you need to make sure, even throughout winter in your garage, is to keep it well watered.
Okay.
You don't want it too wet, but you don't want it to get excessively dry either.
Okay.
All right. Good luck. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And Glenn in Green Bay has a question as well. Glenn, hi.
Hello there. Thank you. I have a couple of apricot trees that have been taken care of for the last 5, 6, 7 years, and we've been getting apricots off them quite regular. Not a lot, but the tree is getting to be so big. I was wondering what would be the proper way of pruning these two trees.
That's a good question, because I'll tell you what, apricots trees typically don't do very
well.
Yeah,
I didn't.
You're very lucky, actually, to have it survive, because they typically have serious problems with cold injury here in the state.
Yeah.
I don't know if Laura has any suggestions on pruning. What I normally do when I get these sorts of questions in the clinic, we have an excellent publication through our Learning Store site, which is on growing stone fruits in Wisconsin, which includes information on apricots and has really excellent information on how to prune them. Pruning fruit trees is a little different.
It's different than
pruning woody ornamentals.
Mm-hmm.
So my suggestion would be to check out that publication at the Learning Store. And there's a great series of publications called Growing Whatever Fruit Crop in Wisconsin, and they are all excellent publications.
Yeah, it's really good. So learningstore.uwex.edu, I think, is the, or UW Extension Learning Store. If you type that in the search engine, you're going to get it.
And again, just do a search once you get there on stone fruits, and that should pull up that publication. Mm-hmm. It's a nice little booklet, and it's well worth the price to purchase that particular publication.
Yeah, or you can read it for free online.
You can read it for free online, too. Yes, indeed.
There you go. Good luck, Glenn. Thank you for calling. Bob in Eau Claire has a question. Hi, Bob.
Hi, guys.
Hello.
There. I got you off the speaker. I have a catalpa tree in our front yard, and we planted it the first year we moved here in 2007, 2008, right around there. Every year, the tree has been one of the last trees to leaf out and bloom, and frequently, we would have catalpa flowers in the 4th of July.
Wow.
This year.
That's late.
It truly is. I mean, I look at all the other catalpa trees. There are quite a few in the Eau Claire area, mature trees, and they're well past flowering and full leaf and whatnot. This year, the leaves didn't come, and the leaves didn't come, and they didn't come. And finally, in mid-July, we got a smattering of leaves on a few of the mm-hmm. branches,
mm.
but by and large, the tree was bare.
Yeah.
It did produce a few flowers, but nothing about that tree looked, quote, healthy.
Well, probably wasn't healthy, Laura.
Mm-hmm. No, I was thinking it. Wonder if it has verticillium wilt.
Yeah, I think there were probably problems with the tree even before that. So I'm wondering whether there were root issues with that tree when you first planted it. We had a really terrible winter in 13-14, which may have caused some damage to the tree. From a disease standpoint, the most common disease I see on that tree is something called verticillium wilt. It's a fungal disease. The fungus gets up inside the water conducting tissue in the tree and blocks it off. So you get a lot of branch dieback with that, usually kind of a sectional dieback of the tree. And it can cause some issues with the trees leafing out in the spring. So that would be another thing that I would be concerned about. If you are dealing with verticillium, you need to be very careful about what you replant in that area because that fungus has a relatively wide host range.
Oh, really?
So
okay.
What you might want to...
That answers my next question is should I put it... cut that down and put another one in its place.
It doesn't sound like it's doing well, so I think removing the tree is not a bad option, but I would not replace another catalpa in that area without knowing exactly what killed that tree off.
Yeah. I wouldn't go to a catalpa, but could you recommend a fast-growing deciduous tree that would do well? Now, I've got a couple of maples in the yard. I've got a couple of lindens. But that where we put that tree, it was right on the corner of the house where we were hoping it would provide shade in the summer afternoons.
Okay, so it's obviously then not getting it's getting sun then. That's an area that getting
full sun.
Okay.
Okay. One thing, it's really important to get your tree tested to see if it actually did have verticillium wilt, because I'm worried about your other maples in the yard.
And lindens.
And lindens.
Linden is also a host as well.
Right.
Although we oftentimes have situations where a tree will have verticillium and a lot of other susceptible trees in the vicinity will not get it for a long, long time. So it isn't a guarantee that you'll have, if it is verticillium, that you'll have problems with all your trees. But we do recommend doing that. You could submit a sample through my clinic if you'd like to verify. The other thing is simply to assume it is verticillium and proceed accordingly. And then you're relatively limited in terms of good trees.
Yeah, there's a number. You're in Eau Claire. That's zone 4, I think.
Yeah.
In Eau Claire.
Yeah.
One thing, you mentioned that the catalpa was planted on the corner of your house. You want to make sure to keep trees at least 20 feet, big trees, that is, at least 20 feet from your house because of root issues, especially some of the maples and poplars. They can really destroy foundations as well as your sewer system. Mm-hmm. Secondly, I have a couple recommendations. There are some new hybrid elms out there. One is called Triumph Elm and the other is Accolade Elm. There's others as well, and they don't have any American elm in them, but they've been bred for Dutch elm disease resistance, which, again, doesn't mean immune.
Yeah, it doesn't mean they won't get them. And I have seen those varieties with Dutch elm disease.
Even Triumph?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
really?
Yeah.
I haven't seen that. Other species, you could also use... I am a big fan of our oaks, our native oaks, in particular chinkapin oak, which is in the white oak group. So it can get oak wilt, but if it's discovered soon enough, you can treat your trees versus some of the red oaks. They will die within one season. I would stay away from maples only because you already have maples in your yard. You want to increase diversity. Another tree that I like is... the male Amur cork trees, not the female, and one of the outstanding trademarks is called Eyestopper cork tree, and that does not produce fruit, so it's not going to become invasive. It does not sucker up, and that's got amazing bark and no fruit, fantastic bright yellow fall color.
Mm, what is it again?
It's called Eyestopper Amur cork tree, and it's Philodendron amaranth. And I know that's on the invasive species list, but if you get, the cultivar name is Longnecker, trademark is Eyestopper, and it was selected here at the UW-Madison Arboretum, and it is one of the prettiest trees in the Arboretum.
And it is not invasive.
No, it's a male. It does not produce fruit.
What do you think about Katsura? Because that's another one.
Katsura is a beautiful tree. I love that tree, but it is very sensitive to drought. You have to water it during a drought period. And if you don't, you'll have dieback and sometimes cankers come in.
Because I have a Katsura, and that's technically resistant or immune to vert, and it has beautiful fall color.
Oh, it's a fantastic tree. It just, you got to plant it where it's going to get water.
Yeah.
There you go. Good luck. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call, Bob. Brian Huddleston and Laura Jull, our guests today on this edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller. Brandy Funk, our on-air producer, again for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Next week on Garden Talk, we'll be visiting with Melinda Myers, and she's going to be answering your gardening questions. That's next week on Garden Talk. Right now, visiting with Brian Huddleston, Director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at UW-Madison in our Department of Plant Pathology, and Laura Jull, Professor and Extension Specialist for Woody Ornamentals in the Department of Horticulture at UW-Madison. Join in. You can email us at talk@WPR.org. You can post photos on our Facebook page and also questions as well on our Facebook page. Title of our page is The Larry Mueller Show. And if you want to see a photo of a frontier elm, you might just go to our Facebook page right now, because Sarah sent us a photo, and she's wondering if it will, the frontier elm that she has, will it outgrow the curved trunk? And you can see that there is some curvature in the trunk, but
it's mainly at the top of the tree. I think, looking at this picture, I think it will straighten up, but, you know, elms have kind of that vase-shaped form. The frontier elm has less of a vase-shaped form than some of the other elms. One thing I am concerned about in this picture is the staking.
Yeah.
I'd like to know how long that's been on. You should only leave stakes on trees for 1 year, and then they must come off. You want some slight movement in the trunk tissue to build caliper. That has been proven that you have some slight movement in the trunk, caliper or the diameter of the trunk increases more, and you have better rooting. And I'm not sure if that's, is that rubber hose?
Looks like rubber hose.
Yeah, rubber hose is bad. You don't want to use rubber hose around the trunks of trees. I've actually seen trees grow over those rubber hoses, and then over time they become girdled from the rubber hose that goes around the tree. I've actually gone through my neighborhood at night, and if I see trees like this, I physically clip the rubber hose off. So it looks, I feel sorry for the tree, but
it looks from the message like it was just planted in May of this year.
Okay, I didn't see that. So yeah, keep it on for the winter, and then take it off in the spring. But if it's not a windy area, and if it's not a bare root tree, if it's actually came with a soil ball, you really don't have to stake them. Yep. But if it is bare root, you definitely do.
All right. There we go. Thanks a lot for that photo and question. Let's turn to David and Madison next. Hi, David.
Hi, folks. Enjoy your show, Larry.
Thank you.
I have a cherry pinpoint tree in the backyard, which ironically has neither cherries nor pinpoints, for that matter. I live on the outskirts of Madison in a new development, so it's kind of like a sequoia, you know, in a new neighborhood with a bunch of saplings. So I'm really careful about it. It was left over from a farmer's spread. So it's a massive tree, beautiful, but it's branching out into the neighbor's yards, and I'd like to trim it. But, of course, you know, I have the brown thumb, and anything I turn, touch turns to, you know, automatic death when it comes to flowers and plants and trees. So I wondered, is there a correct season for trimming a tree? Should I be doing it? Should I call in somebody who knows how to do this? What would you recommend?
Okay, first of all, is there any power lines near this tree?
No.
Okay, because if there's, and this is for anybody, if your tree that you want to prune has power lines near it, or the tree is growing through the power lines, that's when you call the utility companies. Do not try to prune any tree that's growing near power lines, please. That's how people are killed. Second of all, it's a cherry, and there's a lot of disease problems with cherries. I would recommend doing pruning in the dormant season, and I do have a fact sheet on the three-point method of branch removal and how to do it properly on the UW Extension Horticulture Team's website.
Actually, you can go to my clinic,
or Brian's website.
Clinic website, which is pddc.wisc.edu. We have a fact sheet section. Just go into the all, select all, and that'll give you a alphabetical listing, and then there's pruning deciduous trees fact sheet.
It's not on the Learning Store. It's actually on both Brian's website and the Horticulture Team's website. And if it's a neighbor, granted, if the tree is in your yard, the actual trunk of the tree is in your yard, but growing into your neighbor's yard, you can prune it. As far as I know, you can. But I would talk to your neighbor, too.
Yeah.
And the other thing is if you're uncomfortable doing this, certainly take a look at the fact sheet and read. And if you feel uncomfortable, hire
certified arborist
to do it for you.
And make sure they're certified. There are people out there that say they're arborists, and they're not. They're hack and whack. And so I would, if you go on the Wisconsin Arborist Association website, they have a certified they have a list of certified arborists for hire, and you can search by your county. But you definitely want somebody who's ISA, International Society of Arboriculture, certified.
And there are several here in Madison.
That's right. You're in Madison. There's tons.
Yeah.
Yeah, I imagine. You said the dormant season, Laura. What is a dormant season?
Winter. Late winter, you know.
So after it's frozen and snowed.
Yep.
Yeah. I usually recommend, we have that little period in January or early February where it warms up just a little bit so you don't freeze to death when you're outside.
Usually about the second week of January.
Yes, indeed, and I think that's a great time to prune.
Yeah, and with pruning, you work up a little sweat. Yeah, you get warm.
Yeah. There you go. Thanks a lot for calling. That used to be called, where I grew up, that was called case weather. And we grew a lot of tobacco. Many farms grew tobacco, and you hung the tobacco in tobacco sheds. And then in January, when you had case weather, you'd get a warming, and then there'd be a little moisture in the air. You could take those tobacco plants out of the shed and then strip the leaves. And it would come down, and they weren't brittle because there was a little moisture in the air.
So interesting.
Always second or third week of January, almost always there's a little bit of case weather, as it was called. Ron in Richville Township, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, good morning, Larry. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
I've got a couple questions. The first one is concerning my blackberry bushes. I have blackberry bushes, and then also I have fall-bearing blackberries. And I had heard a comment earlier about waiting till the leaves are off to prune those. Is that correct?
You know, I'm not real familiar with raspberries or fruit trees and when to prune. I'm speaking on the ornamentals side. Brian?
Yeah, again, that's not my area of expertise either, although I think it's a great idea to do the pruning because that thins things out, makes the plants
air
less
circulation.
Prone to diseases. But again, I mentioned before one of these publications for apricots that would tell you how to prune. There's also
a good sister
publication called Growing Raspberries in Wisconsin, and that would have the sort of pruning information that you need. It will tell you which canes to prune out. It will tell you when to do the pruning.
Yep.
And it's a really great reference, and it's available through our Learning Store. Now, do you have true blackberries, or do you have black raspberries?
These are supposedly true blackberries.
Blackberries, okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, you can tell the difference when you pull the fruit off. If you leave a little white thing on the plant, that's a raspberry. If it comes off with the fruit, it's a blackberry.
Yeah, they're delicious.
I haven't had much luck with it yet. Last year, it got some disease. I pruned them out, but they sure came back with the nice weather we had.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. They will.
Well, we had a particularly, from a disease standpoint, bad year this past summer because it was so wet in many areas.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
that moisture is very favorable for a lot of disease-causing organisms to do their thing.
Sure.
Yeah, raspberries, they need full sun and good air circulation. Same with blackberries.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
All right. Thanks, Ryan.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, appreciate the call. Sue in Webinar, let's go to you next. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry and guests. I'm Sue, yes, a volunteer in our main street in Wabino, Wisconsin, in the North Woods.
Oh, Wabino.
Wabino, right. And we have nine large hardy mums, and they're mm-hmm. in pots along our main street. Mm-hmm. And next week, we plan to remove them to get ready for installing some Christmas trees in those same pots.
Okay.
So we need to disturb or remove, and we were hoping to, you know, use these again next fall if possible.
Okay.
We were told they're the kind that we could do that, but looking for some tips on overwintering.
Okay. There are a lot of so-called hardy mums. Some, they're hardy if you're in Ohio, and some that are actually really hardy up here. My favorite, just a side note, some of my personal favorites are the Minnesota mums, Mammoth mums, Maxi mums. There's a bunch of them. Those, it's amazing. They get within, I'd say, about a 2 feet tall and 3 feet wide in one season. I have some in my yard. And they look like boxwood. They're so huge.
Boy.
And they are rock hardy. They come back for me every year, and I don't do a thing to them. I don't protect them. I don't do anything. Now, some of the other mums that are sold as labeled hardy, you may not have, especially since you're in the Northwoods, you may not have success overwintering these. So when you take them out of a pot, I don't know if you have an unheated garage or unheated, I don't know, warehouse or somewhere where you can put those plants in a container with soil, water them thoroughly, keep them off the floor, and try to overwinter them that way. And then make sure to check them over winter that they don't get too dry, because if they get too dry, they'll die. But a lot of these mums also, you can also plant them in the landscape, but I don't know what particular cultivars you have specifically, and that makes a huge difference.
Okay.
Another thing is after the leaves have dropped, some people like to leave the top part, the foliage there all winter. You can do that. It acts kind of like a windbreak. And make sure there's mulch around the root system, and try to overwinter it that way. But it really depends on the cultivar. There's huge differences.
Okay, right. Great. Mm-hmm. I think we can do this, and we will probably double check with the provider of where we got them from. But adding a lot of soil and mulch, you said, around them, and light. Did you mention light? Should they be in a dark or light location?
Well, when I say putting soil around them, that's if you're putting it in a container. Yeah, you don't want bare roots. You want
right. Yeah, you understand, though, we have to we will be removing
right.
them from the pot and
right.
leaving most of the dirt in the pot
right.
for the Christmas trees, and then putting these into another container.
Right. Mm-hmm. We want to make sure you get as much of the root system as you can.
Gotcha.
And when they're in an unheated garage, there is no light. And that's fine. They're dormant. You just want to try to keep that crown and that root system alive.
Perfect. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And I really want to encourage everyone today to go to our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show, because there is a video on the page of how to manage gnomes in the garden with a University Extension fellow from Utah State. And when I'm talking about gnomes, I'm talking about G-N-O-M-E, gnome management. And Brian, you've seen this video.
I watched it this morning after you emailed it and made some pithy comments back to you.
It is one of the funniest, and it's done just as you'd expect an extension 2 or 3 minute piece
to be. Very serious. And
all done very seriously. And you have gnomes, the heads are coming out of the soil.
And some great stop motion.
Yeah, and some great stop motion on there as well. Mm-hmm. So please, if you want a really good chuckle, and every gardener could use a chuckle from time to time, go to our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show, and right kind of in the center of the page, you're going to see something called Gnome Management in the Garden. And please go. And if you watch it while the show's on, call in and let me know what you thought of it. Let's go to Dan and Laval next Hi, Dan. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Quick question about, we have some spirea shrubs in our house.
Okay.
And they've gotten to the point where they've gotten out of control in size. And wondering if we can trim those back to keep them more in a manageable size, and what would be the best time of year or not to trim them back at all, or what to do with them.
Do you know what type of spirea they are?
Oh, golly, I don't know. They've got kind of a red flowering thing, and they're nice looking, but they've just gotten to be kind of unmanageable in size.
Are they like about 2 to 3 feet tall, or are they?
Yeah.
Okay. It sounds like you got Japanese spirea,
okay.
And that particular spirea, I've cut them to the ground, left about 2 to 3 inches behind, cut them low to the ground, and they will still, you know, flower that year in the summertime because they produce their flower buds on new wood. So as the new growth emerges in the spring, it will still flower. And that particular spirea is a summer flowering one, so you're not removing flower buds on it. Other spireas that bloom in the spring, you don't want to do that too, because then you're removing all your flowers. But dormant season pruning, good time of year to do that. You know, wait till the leaves fall off, and then you can do it. I personally do I don't have Japanese spirea in my yard, but I used to do landscaping for a living, and we would do it in early spring before growth emerged. We just, with the Japanese spirea, just cut them back.
Well, you know, as well, we cut our peony bushes right down to nothing, and basically just cut them way back as well then.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And they'll come back. Well, great. Well, thank you.
Sure. Yep. Thanks a lot for calling. And Stephen Thiensville, your turn. Hi, Steve.
Hi, good morning, folks. How are you all doing?
Good.
Doing well.
Great.
Okay, I moved to a new house in Thiensville, and in my old house I had an unruly prairie garden. Now I'm going to go for a nice formal garden. My wife was tired of the crazy prairie garden. So I'm going to try to make a potager garden with boxwood hedges, which I've never done hedges.
Okay, and your question is?
What type of variety?
Okay.
Other formal border plant suggestions?
There's a number you can use. Boxwood being very common for formal sheared hedges. You can also do that with arborvitae or white cedar. Granted, you're not going to take a tree and turn it into a low hedge, but you plant, you know, the shrubs out, and you can keep them clipped. You do not want to do this with juniper. Juniper doesn't have latent buds farther back down on the stem, and if you do this to a juniper, you're going to see a lot of dead wood. It's going to look ugly, so you don't want to do it to that. Another plant you can do formal evergreen sheared hedges is hemlock, but hemlocks do need great soil, good moisture, and some partial shade because they can winter burn quite readily. If you're going with boxwood, I'm not sure where Thiensville is.
That's over in Ozaukee County.
Mequon.
Oh, Mequon. Okay. Yeah, you're warmer than us. So, yeah, you can grow boxwood there. There is a boxwood blight that I do want Brian to address. There are some cultivar differences between the susceptibility, and they've actually shown that some of the dieback is often due to winter injury.
Yeah, I'm more worried, quite frankly, at this point on boxwood about winter injury than...
They're hardy, but...
Yeah. What varieties do you normally recommend for...
Well, for example, I've not had dieback issues except for where the dog pees on it.
Yeah.
They like boxwood, but I have green velvet, actually, and that can get the blight. I'm trying to remember, there's one in particular that's resistant, and I can't remember the cultivar name. But again, resistant doesn't mean immune.
Yeah, we have not seen this disease that Laura's mentioning in the state yet. It's a fungal disease. What you normally see as a symptom are small black spots, maybe about an inch in diameter, that will form on the leaves, maybe slightly smaller than that. It will move on to the branches and cause branch dieback, and it's been a problem farther east than here in Wisconsin. We have not, like I said, documented it here in Wisconsin.
Really?
But what I see more of is, again, the winter injury. We get a lot of samples of boxwood coming into my clinic where the branches are dead, and sometimes we see verticillium wilt, which we discussed earlier.
Really?
On that host. It's
boxwood?
Not real common, but we do see it occasionally. But we do see them coming out of dormancy and then kind of drying up. They are not hydrated well over the winter, so you want to make sure they're well watered going into the wintertime.
Yeah, I know of Johnson's Nursery in Menominee Falls. They said that they have had boxwood blight. I don't
Yeah, again. We've never seen a sample come into the clinic, and I've never seen a formal report of that come through the State Department of Agriculture as well. They may have had it and not reported it, but yeah. We'd like folks to report that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. There we go. Thanks a lot for calling, Steve. Appreciate your call. And you mentioned dog pee, and Marita on Facebook says, I bought a house this summer, and one of the trees, bottom 2 feet of the trunk, is almost white from being urinated on from the previous owner's dog. Will this kill the tree? Any ideas or thoughts?
You know, that's a good question. I have two dogs myself, and I take them to the dog park. And over the course of the last 10 years, there's been trees at the entrance of the dog park that is, I guess, a rest stop for male dogs to pee on. And yes, the bark turned white, and the trees are dead now. It's very caustic, especially to thin bark species. If it's like a thick bark species, like an oak, it's usually not a huge problem, but it can, over time, if it's a young tree, really damage the bark, and then other organisms move in.
Arborvitae is really sensitive.
Yeah,
as
arborvitae
well.
Is very. Yeah.
White cedar. I've had samples of that come in where we open the box and we know it right as we open the box that it's dog urine because of the smell.
Yeah. Are they trying to prevent further injury? Is that what's.
Well, I think she's just wondering. She bought the house and.
Yeah.
Here's this trunk of this tree. Is it going to live? Or
well, it depends on how bad the damage is. It depends how big the tree is. It depends on the health of the tree. If the tree is healthy, then yeah, it'll form new wood and new bark every year as the tree gets bigger. So if it's still looking good, you know, make sure it's watered during drought, and it should be okay. Unless it's severe enough that it's really harmed the tree.
What, Brian, what diseases were really the most prominent this year?
In terms of what I see in the clinic, late blight, but we asked for late blight samples to be sent in. That's a tomato and potato disease. That has a huge impact on our commercial potato and fresh market tomato production industries here in the state. And so we actually request people send that in when they think they see it. Quite frankly, if you send a sample into my clinic and it's a tomato or potato and invoke the words, late blight, we will do a free diagnosis for you, even if you don't think it's late blight. And some people have tried to do that with, like, oaks, and I say, no, sorry.
But, that's a stretch.
Yeah. But definitely, if you have a tomato or a potato where there's a lot of dieback, yeah, get a sample into our clinic. And again, if you go to my website, that's at pddc.wisc.edu website, there's information on submitting a sample. Other diseases, we tend to see a fair amount of oak wilt that comes into the clinic. We don't get a lot of the tar spot in, but that's such an easy disease to diagnose that nobody yeah. sends it into us. We get a lot of weird diseases, quite frankly, that because it's the strange, difficult stuff that we tend to see in the clinic. We're always looking, I mentioned verticillium before, we're always looking for new hosts for that particular fungus, and we've identified potentially 4 new hosts for that. We've got to complete some additional work to verify that, but we've gotten it out of some odd things.
I can't tell you how many times on Garden Talk it's come up, this is sort of a different matter, wondering, and the expert is wondering whether it might be an insect or a disease issue with a particular plant. And how do you tell if a damage to a plant is caused by insects or some other fungus or other pathogen?
You oftentimes can't. And a lot of times the symptoms will mimic one another, and that's part of the reason we're around. Quite frankly, if you think you have an insect problem, if you go to my website again and look up where you mail a sample to me, you can mail a sample to our insect diagnostic lab, care of the same mailing address, and it'll go to PJ Leash, who will do a diagnostic on it. If it looks like it's a disease problem, they'll bring it down to my lab and we'll do a disease diagnosis on it. But oftentimes we have things that we trade back and forth, and I'll say, I think it's insect. They'll say, no, I think it's disease. And then we'll go back and forth. We kind of negotiate and try to figure out what it is. But sometimes it's neither. Sometimes it's fertility related.
Oh.
Sometimes it can have to do with environmental conditions. We've seen a lot of trees and shrubs, particularly what I call fruit trees and shrubs. So cherries, yeah. plums, apples, pears, that sort of thing that are still showing what appears to be damage from that really awful winter that we had in 13-14. So we get branch dieback. Everybody thinks it's a disease called fire blight, but when we look for the organism that causes that disease, we can't find it. We can't see any other disease-causing organisms. And so we're chalking up a lot of the dieback just to environmental stress.
Hmm, interesting. Brian Huddleston and Laura Gell, our guests today. I'm Larry Mailer for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for joining us today for Garden Talk on the Ideas Net. Brian Huddleston and Laura Gell from the University of Wisconsin. Brian in the Department of Plant Pathology, Laura in the Department of Horticulture, both, and Laura certainly with UW Extension as well. Great to have them along. Join in, 1-800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mailer Show. And Don and Racine up next with a question. Let's go there. Hi, Don.
Hello. I've got recently cut down several spruce trees and Norway pines, and I'm planting some arborvitaes in their place. Others I've trimmed up. The problem was they were dying. The lower limbs were dying. They're about 35 feet tall, but so I've trimmed them up about 15 feet. So two questions about that. One is I've got some really healthy-looking arborvitaes I'm going to plant this afternoon. What do you recommend? Do you recommend a fertilizer or something to go in with it as I plant those arborvitaes, or any technique issues for planting them? And then the second is, I'd like to put something under. I don't want to cut down all these trees. They're trimmed up about 15 feet. I'd like to plant something under for new growth in that area, but I'm concerned that, you know, maybe there's still not going to be enough light for arborvitaes. Is what type of planting can you put under a pine or a Norway pine or a spruce that will grow in the amount of light?
Okay. First question I have for you, because it was like a red flag. As soon as you said arborvitae and there was a bunch of dead branches on the bottom, do you have a deer problem?
No, there's no deer. Well, I mean, we've got some deer running through the yard in the suburbs here, but it's not a. There's no eating that I can.
Okay, because that is like their favorite salad bar plant.
Yeah, num num to the
deer.
Yeah,
num num. That and ewes, they just love them. Second thing regarding the arborvitae, if you're planting them right now, it's a little late. And the reason why you can do it, but I'm hesitant when it comes to evergreens, because they don't have enough time to start to establish a new root system before that ground freezes. Going through winter, you may have significant dieback, a winter burn on some of these plants because the soil is frozen and those roots that came from the original plant can't take up or can't get the moisture out of the soil because it's frozen. So the top part just desiccates like crazy. You do not want to fertilize at time of planting. That is an old method of planting. I do not recommend that anymore. The most important thing you're trying to do is get that plant established and new roots put on. So watering is critical. If these plants dry out, again, they're I don't know if it came in a container or bald and burlapped. Containerized.
They're bald.
They're bald
and burlapped.
Yeah, that's better.
Pretty good size.
Yeah.
Pretty healthy looking five-footers.
Yeah. The the evergreens that are in containers and then planted in the yard, they often dry out really quick. Don't use fertilizer. In terms of maybe trying to protect them for winter. I hate doing this because it looks ridiculous, but you can wrap them in burlap. Actually, you don't want to do it super tight. You want to keep about a foot space in between, like put some 4-foot stakes in the ground, and then you're creating like a tent that goes around the actual arborvitae, but not on the top. And that helps break the wind and maybe prevent some winter burn. But you also want to make sure you mulch these plants on top of the soil after you plant them. Again, November is really late for evergreens, and we've seen a lot of winter injury when they go in this late the next year.
Yeah.
Did you want to comment about the burlap and maybe the wire basket on the root system when they're planting?
Sure. I would definitely. Usually arborvitaes don't have a wire basket, but if there is a wire basket, it needs to come off. Get rid of it. There's too much new research out there that, and I've seen this in my own yard where some trees died. I bought the house. They had some sick-looking spruce, mm-hmm. Brian's favorite plant. we dug it up, and sure enough, that wire basket was...
Still on?
Still on.
Oh, boy.
Oh, yeah. It doesn't break down, folks. It's steel. And it doesn't break down.
And what about the burlap?
The burlap, I'm a fan of removing as much as you can.
Yeah, I am too.
And especially on the top of the root ball, because it, especially when it gets really dry, it acts like a wick. And it can pull moisture away from the plant. Also, it's can sometimes, especially a treated burlap, it can be hydrophobic, meaning when you water it, the water just drips off to the side. It doesn't get down to that root system. I remove as much as possible, personally.
Yep. There we go. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And Georgia in Lone Rock. Hello. Thank you for calling. Oops, wait a minute. I first need to push the button to get you on. There you go.
All right.
Yeah, we're good now, Georgia. Thanks for calling.
Okay, thank you. I have nine young hemlock trees that I'm trying to get going. I picked them because they're next to walnuts, and I understood that they would grow all right in spite of the walnut trees. And this is their second year. And at the end of last winter, at the beginning of spring, they turned orange. And I was advised to water them heavily, and they recovered. But so they had sort of a rocky start this second year. And they did beautifully all summer. But now one end of this row of nine is turning yellowish. And the other end is not. So I don't know, maybe that's yet to come. And I was just wondering, is it possible that there's something in the soil? There are walnut trees on one end of the row, and there's an old lilac bush on the other end. I don't know if that has any effect. It's probably 100 years old. And it's had plenty of water all summer.
Okay. And so they're looking bad right now?
Well, I don't know if yellow is bad. Yellowish.
Yeah, not evergreen. That's bad.
Not healthy. Right.
But one thing to know, if it's the inner needles that are turning right now, that's normal this time of year. You see that on white pines. You see that on arborvitaes. You see that on a number of evergreen species where in fall they actually shed their older inner needles. And it depends how long they retain them. It depends on the species. But if it's the new growth that is yellowing, that's a problem.
Is there anything I can do at this point? Or
well, you know, not seeing the plant, I don't really know. But, you know, if it's a hemlocks, need shade. They can be put in sun, but they need to be protected from winter sun and winter winds because they winter burn very easily. They also require an excellent soil. Hemlocks are very picky. They like an organic, loamy soil, slightly acid. They're not clay tolerant at all. And hemlocks are not forgiving. If they get too dry, they will yellow. And, you know, if something dries out so much and then they're watered, I worry about root rot issues moving in.
Yeah, I'd also wonder about the soil pH in the area.
Yeah.
Since you're from Lone Rock, there may be relatively high soil pH, which could be negatively impacting the shrubs as well.
Well, we did amend the soil when we planted them. It's clay soil, but we, you know, we put organic matter in when we planted them.
Okay. One thing, when you're planting in a clay soil, you don't want to be amending a hole. You want to be either building up the soil like a raised bed. I've done that in my yard. I brought in like 50 cubic yards of peat topsoil compost mix, and it's beautiful for growing plants. Hemlocks are very sensitive to poor drainage. If they're too wet or if the soil doesn't drain well, they won't live.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call, Georgia. I want to give Jeff in La Crosse a chance to join us. Jeff, hi. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, good morning. I have a question. About the first week of October, we were walking in the woods up in northern La Crosse County, and around the base of, I believe it was mostly white oaks, there were these little fuzzy things growing on the ground all over, and there were also some growing on the leaves and or the stems of the leaves, and they were almost about the size. They kind of looked like little pussy willows, but they were a little round, and they were all over the ground. It's like somebody dropped a bunch of little bitty cotton balls or something. And then there was another one that was growing on the oak trees that kind of looked like a grape, maybe a green grape or a ground cherry.
Yeah. I was wondering if you had any idea for identifying either one of those.
Yeah, the green one that you're talking about, was that on leaves or on the small branches?
Small branches, yep.
Yeah, that could be an insect gall. There are certain insects, and oaks get tons of insect galls. And that's a cosmetic problem. Now, the whiter ones that you're talking about, I'm not quite sure exactly what that would be. If you happen to have a digital camera and see those again, what I would suggest that you do is take some photos and email them to me. And again, you can, if you go to my clinic website, you can email. Or you can take the photos, send the photos to your county extension office, and they can help you out as well.
Yeah, they weren't quite attached to the ground. They would move really easy, but sometimes one was growing right on top of the other one. But they were just little fuzzy ball, kind of like a pussy willow.
Yeah, it doesn't ring a bell, although there are some of the insect galls, again, that can look very fuzzy like that. So I'm wondering whether or not that could be what you're dealing with.
Yeah, if it was just on the stems or leaves, I would think maybe scale, but you're saying it's on the ground, too?
On the ground, all over, yeah.
They will fall off, though, sometimes off of the leaves, from what PJ has told me. Yeah. So they can become detached.
We thought they had maybe fallen from the tree, but they were all sitting upright.
Okay.
They weren't in any random pattern. They were all the same direction pointing up. So,
I think a photo, if you can get it for us, would be the way to go to try to figure out what that is.
It'd be really cool to see, actually.
Yeah, it would.
Might have to wait till next October to do that.
Okay. Well, that's all right. Hopefully we'll all still be here.
All right, thank you.
You're welcome.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. That's part of the fun part about this job, isn't it? There's always, you know a lot, you've seen a lot, but, pretty much every year there's something that, gosh, I didn't know that or I hadn't seen that. And that's the fun part about this job and the fun part about being a gardener, too. Brian Huddleston, one of our guests today, director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic in the UW-Madison Department of Plant Pathology. And our other guest today, Laura Jell, professor and extension specialist for woody ornamentals in the Department of Horticulture at UW-Madison, with us here for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you with us here for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mueller, and I've got a couple of great guests for you today to talk about plant diseases and care of your woody ornamentals. Brian Huddleston, director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at UW-Madison in the Department of Plant Pathology. Laura Jell, professor and extension specialist for woody ornamentals in the Department of Horticulture at UW-Madison. And great to have them along, and thanks for listening in. Questions for them, call us at 800-642-1234. You can post on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, and if you have photos, something, maybe you've got a disease photo, Brian can take a look and see what he can come up with. Or shoot us an email at talk@wpr.org. Again, our Facebook title is The Larry Mueller Show. That's where you go for that. And I'm going to mention again, gnome management in the garden is a video on our Facebook page that you just go and see it. As you're a gardener, you're going to love that. You're going to love that video. It's just a couple, 2-3 minutes, and it's really a lot of fun. And Jane in Superior has a question for us. So let's go to Jane. Thank you for calling.
Well, thank you. When we lived in Green Bay, we grew mums, and they came up every year, and they were beautiful.
Yep.
But since we've moved up here, no matter what I buy, does not winter or it's spindly. And your guest mentioned the name. She called it, I thought, Mammoth Mum.
Yes.
Is that the name?
Yeah, there's several names, but they're from the University of Minnesota.
Oh.
Yeah, and it's they used to be called, I think, Maxi Mums. Now they're Mammoth Mums.
Okay.
And there's different colors, and I have seen them in garden centers in Minneapolis, St. Paul. I haven't been up to Superior for quite some time, so I'm not sure if they sell them during the growing season, but those are they're huge. I mean, I couldn't believe how big they get. And they're very hardy. Now, Superior, you're really pushing it up there, but you're along the lake. You might have some lake effect. Snow is an excellent insulator, of course. Okay. But those are the hardiest of the mums.
Okay, and then you, when it freezes hard, you just cut them down and then...
I don't even...
Next year?
Yeah, you can cut them down. I leave mine, actually.
Oh,
yeah, I'm lazy gardener. And it just kind of acts as a snow catcher.
Okay, well,
but
I'm a fair weather gardener, but I have to cut a lot because of the deer.
Yeah, no.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Joanne emailed us, and this is something we talked about right away in the beginning of the show, but it's worth repeating, I think. Their maple tree in the front boulevard has quarter or 50 cent size large black spots on every leaf.
Yes,
and
indeed.
Silver maple, should I be contacting the city about a problem or not?
No, it's a very cosmetic disease. It's called tar spot. Interestingly, you can see it on silver maple as well. It's just a slightly different fungus that causes the disease on silver versus what you're probably dealing with is Norway maple. So rake up those leaves this fall, get them out of your yard as much as you possibly can, and hope for a little bit of a drier summer next year, particularly when the leaves are first coming out in the spring.
But get rid of those leaves.
Get rid of those leaves, yes.
Yeah.
Or if you're going to use them to kind of mulch your beds, then I would be sure to get out before the trees start to leaf out in the spring and remove them out of the beds.
Yeah, serves as inoculum.
Yes, indeed. Lots of spores.
Mike in Madison has a question, so let's go to Mike. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Hello. I've got a fairly new house, about 8 years old, and we've been planting trees every year. And I've noticed now I've got like a blue-green mold. It's almost like a mold, kind of a spongy type stuff that's
lichens.
Growing on the trunks, and now it's going up the trunks onto the limbs.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like it's killing one of the trees, and looking at all the other ones, doesn't matter what kind, they all have it on.
Yeah, it's most likely what are called lichens. These are kind of a weird, funky combination of an alga and a fungus, and they just like to grow on things. If your trees are dying, they're dying from something else. I've never seen any documentation in the scientific literature that indicates that lichens will kill trees. So they're just growing on those trees. And I think we oftentimes see them on declining trees because I think as the branches start to die, they get kind of leaky. They leak nutrients. And the lichens will kind of use those nutrients as a growth medium. Mm-hmm. But they'll grow on virtually anything. I see them on tombstones at graveyards. They'll grow on old metal agricultural equipment that's been left out in the environment to rust. And actually, you want a lot of really different kinds of lichens in your area because the more lichens you see, the better your air quality is.
Mm-hmm.
So, oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter if it takes over the whole tree. I mean,
no.
The whole tree.
No, they're just growing on the surface. But if you're seeing branch dieback, there's something else going on with that tree. And if it's kind of a general dieback, I would kind of look into the root system to see whether there's some root issues.
Okay.
With those trees, there's something else going on. It's not the lichens that you're dealing with.
It's the one tree that seems to be dying off, and all the other ones seem healthy, but I was just wondering if that had something to do with it.
Probably not, no.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
I liken it.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling, Mike. Appreciate your call. Pat in East Troy, up to you now.
Hi, Larry, Brian, and Laura. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Sure.
I am the... queen of the procrastinators, and I haven't cut back anything that I think I need to for winter, my peonies and hydrangeas particularly.
Mm-hmm.
How far should I cut either of those back?
Okay, what hydrangeas do you have?
Well, they didn't bloom, and I had just put them in spring.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I put a couple of them in last fall, or the fall before this one.
Okay. It really depends on what type of hydrangea you have and how you prune it. If it's like the Annabelle types,
I think that sounds familiar.
Yeah, Annabelle's real common. And that one, in early spring, you can cut it back to the ground, and it will come back and still flower that year because it produces its flower buds on new wood. If it is one of the panicle hydrangeas like Limelight or Tardiva, they're unique. There's a whole range of cultivars for that species. That particular hydrangea, it's hydrangea paniculata, you do not want to do that type of pruning to, because it doesn't sucker from the root system. And so if you cut that one to the ground, you've just basically got rid of your plant. If it's one of the mop head type hydrangeas, like Endless Summer, there's another, the one that I particularly like is called Twist and Shout. There's a bunch of them on the market. The Twist and Shout one, I've had tremendous success with overwintering those, and they flower, geez, for months, in starting in summer, and I had flowers all the way until we had a hard frost, and so that's months in bloom. That one is like Annabelle hydrangea. You're going to want to cut it back to the ground, leave some, you know, about two, three inches of the stems, you know, some buds that are still there, and it will sucker and come back just fine in bloom for you.
There we go. Good luck. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Jerry and Jackson, your turn. Hi, Jerry.
Hi. I have a question about putting the maple leaves that have the tar spots and mulching them into the garden soil.
Yeah, I wouldn't recommend that. Otherwise, you're going to see that disease over and over again on your maple trees. I would be inclined, if you live in an area where you have a municipal place where you can drop off garden waste, I would suggest taking it there, because they will compost it properly, and that will help eliminate the disease-causing organism that's on those leaves. If you don't have that option, deep burying the material so it's covered with a layer of soil would be what I would suggest. That's one way to do it. You don't want to kind of just rototill it into the soil, because you're going to leave little bits of leaf exposed to the air, and that fungus is going to produce spores that will be blown all over the place. The other thing you can do, if you're in a more rural area and it's allowed by local ordinance, you could potentially burn those leaves as well. It's not real environmentally friendly from an air pollution standpoint, but that's probably the best way to get rid of that material. But I wouldn't just kind of casually apply it into your garden.
There we go.
Okay, I was concerned whether it'd be safe for the vegetables.
No, no problem in that sense. That particular organism only infects the maples, so you don't have to worry about that on your vegetable crops.
There we go.
Oh.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it.
One thing I want to mention, it's get your bulbs in the ground before the ground freezes. You know, your daffodils and hyacinths and tulips, and just get them in the ground.
And you can still do that.
And put mulch over the top of the soil, kind of insulates them.
We had a kind of a funny thing about trees and disease, and I was reminded of something I read not too long ago that just hit my funny bone. It was a guy looking at the tree and saying, well, you've got blight. And the owner says, well, look at the bark. The bark is crumbling here. And the expert says, yeah, its bark is worse than its blight.
Yeah.
<Pretty bad. laughs>
I couldn't wait to use that. Yeah. Stephen Fitchburg, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi, I've got a hedge of arborvitaes that are I put up in a staggered toothed pattern, and they're about 6 years old, about 9 foot tall. And I planted them too close together, and I'd like to take four of them and move them in the spring,
mm-hmm.
stretch them out across the whole of my back lot line. I moved one of them last spring, and it's about 7 foot tall. It wasn't getting as much light. It didn't do very well. It's, you know, about 50% green and 50% brown.
Mm.
And I'm wondering, am I going to kill them all if I do that? Or?
Well, here's the situation. They're well established right now. And if you remove, and I do suggest you thin them. If you plant them too close, they're just going to shade each other out and get sparse looking. But if you remove every other one, if you dig them up, don't do it in the fall. Do it in the spring. Again, this is an evergreen, and it's really getting late in the year to move evergreens or plant evergreens. You can, but the chances of winter burn are significantly increased. You would have to dig a fairly large root ball to get as many of the roots as possible. And even at that, you're going to be cutting some of the roots of the trees that you are leaving behind. You can do this. I know people have done it, but when you said it's already, what, like 9 feet tall? That's getting big. You might just be better off just getting some arborvitaes, new ones, and planting them in the new location and thinning the ones that remain.
Yeah, there you go. Good luck. Thanks a lot for calling. Tom in Sun Prairie. Hello. Thanks for calling. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. Star Prairie.
Yes, it's Star, not Sun.
Oh. We're Star Prairie. I don't know that.
Way over in the west side.
Okay.
Of the state. Question on oaks. We have a lot of oaks in our yard, and 65, actually.
Wow. Good for you.
And white. And for the last 2 years, the white will bud out, leaf out, and then drop their leaves in the whole leaf clump falls. Then it grows back new leaves, which seem to struggle a little. And all of our whites are affected, and I've talked to many neighbors in the area that the same thing is happening. Does that sound like anything?
Yeah, do the leaves turn brown before they come off?
You know, no. Well, yeah, they do. They do. They turn brown.
Because my first thought with white oak with leaf loss and then resprouting would be a fungal disease called anthracnose. It's a very common disease on oaks, but in particular, white oak tends to get hit pretty hard. And if we have relatively wet conditions early as the trees are leafing out, that fungus will infect, cause the tissue to die, and oftentimes it's severe enough that the trees will just drop the leaves and then they will sprout again. There are fungicide treatments you could use if you wanted to, but with the number of oaks that you're dealing with, I don't think that's really a sustainable sort of strategy to manage the disease. With the leaf disease, it's kind of like the black or the tar spot we were talking about. Good fall cleanup, if you can, to remove the leaves that have fallen to the ground. That's where the fungus survives the winter. And then just hope for a little bit of drier conditions. It is not a lethal disease. It will not kill the trees. So if it is this anthracnose, but it can cause, it causes a lot of people some heartbreak because they have a tree that looks lovely and then all of a sudden it drops its leaves. But typically they will leaf out about mid-season if they do lose the leaves.
Yep.
Okay, great. Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you for calling. And Patsy in Winona, Minnesota, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. I have a question about a wisteria. I have one that is 12 years old. I don't think it's, there's a couple different kinds. I don't think it's the Chinese, but I'm really not sure. It's done nothing for 10 years, and then the last year or so, my husband trimmed it a little bit so it wouldn't go under the roof, and lo and behold, I got flowers at the end of the few places he trimmed.
Mm-hmm.
But this was like in end of August or September. So we figured out you have to cut... cut it down before it's going to bloom there, but when am I supposed to cut it down, fall or spring?
Okay.
And it's real big. I mean, it's quite large now.
Yeah. I assume from where you are, you probably have the Kentucky wisteria, which is wisteria frutescens variety macrostax. That is a very nice wisteria. It's not invasive. I would caution people out there, do not buy the Japanese or Chinese wisteria. They're not reliably hardy, number one, and number two, they're very invasive, but not the Kentucky wisteria. That's a very nice one, and a great cultivar is called Blue Moon. It's beautiful in bloom. Now, with the Kentucky wisteria, the best way to get it, to trick it to bloom, and I've been telling Allen Centennial Gardens on campus how to potentially prune there, is to get it to bloom. We have a brand new director. He's wonderful. And they did this type of pruning, and guess what? It bloomed.
Yeah.
The key is you want to prune back the lateral branches, not the main branch. You don't want to cut that down to nothing.
Okay.
But the lateral branches, you want to bring them back to only to have about two or three buds or nodes remaining. So you leave about a couple inches, and you always want to cut back on an angle back to a bud. Okay. So leave only about two or three buds behind. And what this does, physiologically, I don't know what happens, but it kind of tricks the plant to say, hey, it's time to flower now. Otherwise, it's just going to be vegetative and just produce leaves and leaves and leaves and never flower.
Exactly what we've done.
Yeah.
But when do we do this? Because I think we've confused the plant because we've cut it whenever it was getting... getting a little too large, you know, whatever time. And like I said, it took us 2 years to realize every place we cut it, there were flowers. So are we supposed to do that in the fall or the spring?
Well, I would do it in very late winter or very early spring.
Oh, okay.
And you may sacrifice some blooms that year, but if it's not flowering anyways, it doesn't really matter. But you're trying to trick that plant, and by doing that each year, you will get flowers. I know people have done this, and they swear by this type of pruning.
Yeah, there you go.
And full sun. Got to have full sun. And last thing, if it's the Japanese or Chinese wisteria, if it's not flowering, that could be because they're not hardy. You want the Kentucky wisteria, which is not invasive.
I do believe that's the one I have.
Yep. Nice one.
Yep. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. A listener, just one more on tar spot. Will I spread? The answer is yes. You will spread if you shred infected leaves. And if you bury them totally under the soil, you probably get away with it, I think Brian said. But what about the neighbors? If the neighbors don't do it...
Yeah, you're basically out of luck because the spores will blow for a ways and those leaves from their yard will blow into your yard and you're just left with the problem. And that's oftentimes an issue with a lot of diseases, is that you can be very diligent in terms of trying to do the right thing for control, but if your neighbors are not doing that, you're out of luck.
Yeah, that's why I'm pretty much figuring we'll have tar spot forever in our neighborhood.
If you're like me, that I do what I call Darwinian gardening, which is basically I let things go and I put plants in, and if they survive, they were meant to be there. If not, they weren't. And I affectionately call my yard the cesspool of pestilence because I have disease problems all over the place. But I use it as an educational tool.
I do too. I have the dry garden. I water everything to make sure they get established. But after that, I don't water them unless it's like the drought of 2012 where I was watering daily. But I want to see what plants are really dry. Drought tolerant, and you know, with the climate changing and getting so weird, and low maintenance sustainable landscaping, I want plants that can tolerate little care, that don't need to be watered on a regular basis. That's just not sustainable.
Most people don't have the time to do that anyway.
No.
We need plants that kind of are able to
that
survive
are tough
on their own.
Tim from Racine wondered if. And I think this, we know the answer to this. If the trunk is in a neighbor's yard, can you trim the branches that overhang your yard? What's the legality of that?
Oh, that...
I would check with the individual municipality on their rules. My understanding is that, yes, you can, but I would double check that with your local folks before you do that.
I'd talk to your neighbor before you do it, too.
Yeah. I actually have that same situation in my own yard. We had to remove a 200-year-old tree from our yard, and which was the only tree in the yard. It was so enormous. And big trees on both sides of, the lots. And the one tree to the sort of the east side, the branches of that great big tree are now, in 3 years' time, have grown, uninhibited across the back of our lawn. And it really isn't bothering all that much, but I've wondered about the legality.
Yeah, I don't know for sure, but... Best always to check, and also if the tree is completely in your yard, meaning the trunk, and you just have overhanging branches... I'm not positive on this, so don't quote me on this, but I think you can prune them. But I would talk to your neighbor before you do anything.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, speaking of talking, we're about done talking. Even though every one of our lines is plumb full, unfortunately, we are out of time. And in 15 seconds, last words of wisdom? Don't prune now.
Well, you can, but I personally like the late winter, early spring, especially with the weather going to be going south real quick.
Yeah.
Yes.
And get your bulbs in, mulch your plants.
Good fall cleanup.
Good fall cleanup.
That's good points. Thank you both so much. You'll be back, I assume.
You invite us, we'll be back.
We will do that. Brian Huddleston and Laura Jell, our guests today. Great to have them along. They'll come back and we'll talk with them again. I mentioned earlier that Next week on Garden Talk, Melinda Myers will join us. Monday at 11, New York Times bestselling Wisconsin author Jennifer Cheverini joins us to talk about her new book. It's good, really good. It's called Christmas Bells. And then 11:45, we'll talk about unplugging technology from our children. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.